Hello, welcome to Boxing Life Stories. This week's episode is brought to you by Premier Sports, who will have live and exclusive coverage of Terence Crawford and Kell Brook in the welterweight world title showdown on Sunday morning, November the 15th. The Crawford-Brook telecast will also include the highly anticipated rematch between WBA super flyweight world champion Joshua Franco and former world champion Andrew Maloney. Premier Sports is available in HD via Sky, Virgin and online via the Premier Player, available on app and desktop. Full coverage begins from 12:30 a.m. on Premier Sports 1, and new customers can sign up from just $9.99 per month via the website www.premiersports.com.
I loved heroes, and you know, I always wanted to be a hero. But you realise all heroes are dead. Yeah, when you get a bit of a name and a reputation for you, you're like King of the Hill and everybody wants to have a pop at you. And the more diplomatic I find, you think it's a weakness. And when you do stand up for yourself, I mean, I've took digs off people for no reason. I've took bottles, chairs, stools, you name it, hammers, stabbed in the neck, stabbed in the ass, stabbed in the leg, slashed on the back. I went away to prison and I've journeyed all over the country and 23 different prisons, probably on every wing. I had a photograph there at the end of the Olympics, me and Daley Thompson squaring up to each other, right? Daley Thompson, the greatest athlete ever,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Squaring up over a girl's phone number from the crowd in the closing ceremony in the Olympics. Seb Coe stood there separating us, Lord Coe as he's called now. Sir Steve Redgrave stood there, and John Lyon, the most ABA titles ever, you know, like on this 40. It got torn, got it mended, and it's gone missing. I know my mum was proud of me, but it must have hurt her, you know, like here's her son who's gone on to saving the Royal Navy as a mine clearance diver, saving the Falklands, gone on to captain the British team in the Olympics, captain England, captain combined services, captain Royal Navy, ABA champion, doing well, and then all of a sudden, a great fall, and he's convicted of murder and a soulmate, you know, and broke her heart.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
Beating me. He said, well, let's pull you back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
He's winning, and there's nothing else.
This is one of the wildest Boxing Life Stories you are likely to hear. I've been up in Liverpool recently with the colourful Brian Schumacher. Brian has been through almost all in his life. I felt a great deal of affection to Brian by the time we were finished chatting. I really enjoyed our time together. I have no idea what to make of him, but he was a lovely chap to me. We spent some great time together. I'll just clue you in a little bit on Brian's background. Brian was the 1984 British Boxing Olympic captain. He fought Virgil Hill in those Olympics. He also served in the Navy. He was a clearance diver and he saw action in the Falklands War. So you've got a guy who was a war hero and an Olympic team captain, and things seem to be going well. There's clearly obviously a backstory to this. He then won his first 11 fights in the pros, including a win over future world champion Johnny Nelson. And then the wheels came off. Brian lost his last 5 fights. He didn't fight again, so his record stood 11 wins and 5 losses. And he then served time on and off. He's done 23 years for murder. It's a crazy story, absolutely crazy. It's one of those you can't make up, and you know, you can hit all the cliches that you like, you know, this only happens in boxing and all the rest of it, but I've never heard anything like this. And I was very pleased to be able to spend some time with Brian a few weeks ago in Liverpool. It was fascinating. He was staying in digs in accommodation that sort of almost like a halfway house. We sort of talk about that here. He's clearly been through it all. He's got a reputation that precedes him. He came across to me as a gentle giant. He's clearly struggling now with the life that he leads now, and maybe even with his past experiences. It's bonkers, you know. As I try to talk about here, you know, where he was to where he wound up and where he is now. It's just one of the most crazy journeys I've ever encountered in boxing. Before we get started, I want to thank my sponsors, including Hanson Lee, who have voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the 2020 Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. And Delco Safety Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. I've mentioned before that we're now on Patreon, so there's plenty of content going up there. So behind the scenes access, different podcasts, surveys, things that you'd like to hear. You get the chance to have your say on future guests on Patreon. We also have an Instagram page, Boxing Life Stories, on Instagram. So the Patreon page is patreon.com/TrisDixon. The Boxing Life Stories page on Instagram is just Boxing Life Stories. Really hope you enjoy this with the fascinating Brian Schumacher. Brian, thanks so much for having us down, mate. Really appreciate it. It's great to see you in living colour, in the flesh.
In the flesh. Yeah, it's good to be home.
So tell me, like, obviously all good stories start at the start. So how did you get into boxing?
Well, as a young lad, I was very shy. I lived a sheltered life. I had a brother who was a year younger, John, and my sister Karen, she was a year younger than him. And I never had many friends. I struggled with a few personal issues when I was a youngster, shy, tried to get attention by being a daft fella, I suppose. But never had many friends. But my brother had loads of friends, so I used to follow my brother up to the gym. And they always catch me following them up to the gym, and they chase me back home. The gym was about a mile away from the home. It was called Thingwall Hall, which is also known as St. Edward's. It was in Knotty Ash, well, Broad Green. And it was a home for mentally and physically handicapped people. So we had our gym there, and obviously some of the patients there used to come in the gym, and we'd play football with them now and again. It was just a thing. I was about 12, 13 years old at the time.
You mentioned football. Were you a blue or red?
That's a long story, that one. I was a red for some time. We were raised as blues, and you couldn't wear red in our house, or say Liverpool. It was like a swear word, you know. My dad was an hard man. He was a hard working man, a hard drinking man. And I suppose that's all he knew, you know. It was obviously learned behaviour, you know, being in the work, that he was a tarmacker, you see. And I just followed the kids when my dad was always in the pub after work, I suppose. And I just followed the lads in the street and went to watch the games. But it was like the adventure for me, you know, having one over on my dad, because I was resentful of him. I loved my dad, don't get me wrong, but I didn't like him, you know. And
was he physical?
He was physical with me to a certain age. But it was his power of his voice that was quite intimidating for me. You know, he only had to raise his voice. He swore a lot. You know, him and my mum had quite a difficult... Well, my mother had quite a difficult life with him, you know. And I think that affected us all. Me being the oldest child, you know, I think I was a bit of a disappointment to my mother, you know. So I always wanted to make her proud of me, you know. I always tried my best to put a smile on her face. We left the home numerous times, not for such long times, you know. It seemed like long times for us, a week or a few days. But it was all the upheaval and all the distress, and I actually went to bed till I was 17, I think it was. Yeah, with the nerves. Yeah, it was really bad.
So you were anxious about being around your dad?
I was anxious about being around anyone, to be honest. Yeah. Anyone that smoked or swore. You know, I remember the cock of the school coming to my house with his friend. My dad was in bed at 8 o'clock, I mean, 14, 15. I was in bed, you know, well, we weren't in bed, but we were upstairs in our bedroom at 8 o'clock. Well, around about that time, that was what time my dad used to get home from the pub, you know, as soon as his van or his car pulled into the drive, we all ran up the stairs, you know. And anyway, he shouted up, "Brian, there's a lad down here who wants to fight you. Do you want to fight him?" I'm like, the lad's name was Sexo. You know, Sexo? Oh, my God. You know, it was quite intimidating to me at the time. And my dad said, I'll never forget the time. He said, when they knocked on with all his mates and you came down the stairs, and he said, it was breaking me heart, he said. He was hammering you, he said. And next minute, he just turned him around and started beating on him. I was always getting picked on in school, you see, because of obviously the stench of me dried up piss on my underpants. I took quite a lot of bullying.
Yeah.
You know, it was an adventure getting to school, an adventure getting out of school. You know, I had to go the long way round or hide and seek. I was getting hung up on coat hangers in school. I was getting my head flushed down the toilets. A lot of things, you know. There was a family there called the Fulhams. I remember their youngest lad, Peter. He was younger than me. And Stephen and Wally. I'll never forget them. And they used to hold me down while Peter used to jump all over me. Yeah. I'd get my clothes, well, not my clothes robbed, but, you know, I'd get ragged everywhere. I'd get my dinner money robbed off me all the time. And had the girls stick up for me a few times, called Linda Johnston. Yeah, Anne Kennedy.
You remember all this stuff?
I've got quite a lot going on in my head. Yeah. I had a lot of time to reflect while I was on my holidays. And, it was mainly contained of violence. Yeah.
So during when you started boxing then, did people stop picking on you?
They still pick on me to this day, believe it or not. You just think it, because I'm... Well, I think I'm a nice fella, you know, I try my best with everyone. You know, I like putting smiles on people's faces, that's my forte, so to speak. It can get picked on by the authorities, you know, you feel like you're getting picked on by them, you know, when you do stand up for yourself.
So did boxing help with confidence?
Exactly, that's exactly what it done to me. I remember where we boxed at Tingwall Hall, there was an old man. He used to train SFX, which is St. Francis Xavier's Boxing Club. A guy called Frank Hope won the middleweight title from there. So this Tom Tug Wilson lived up in our area, and he was training the lads up in Tingwall Hall with one of the greatest men I've ever met called Les McLean. Les Nasal, the lovely people. I mean, I've met some wonderful people in my time, in my life, and these upstanding, lovely people. He didn't have a clue about boxing, we didn't really know, but we got as far as the English semi-finals at one time. And that was only because if you won the West Lancashire in Cheshire, you know, the first one to do that was getting a Bainey steak. You know what a Bainey Inn was?
Gone.
Yeah, it's a steak bar. It was like back in the day, 70s, you know what I mean? It was a steak bar, a Bainey Inn it was called. But going to the Liverpool Stadium for the ABA prelims, you know, we were told that if we win the West Lancashire Cheshire title, we will get a Bainey steak. So, and I was the only one to do it, the first one to do it, yeah.
How did it come about you joining the Navy then?
Well, like I say, we got as far as the English semi-finals in Gloucester. I was actually lifting weights in the hotel room, if I remember rightly. Les McLean had me using weights. And like as you go on with your experience in the boxing, you learn what to use and when to use and what to train and you know, what part of your body to train and that, and I went to relax and that. And obviously that should have been a relaxing day. And I fought a guy called Steve Buttle from Basingstoke. It was a scrappy fight, I suppose. I thought I'd won it. Unfortunately, he got the decision against me. Good luck to Steve, if you like. And I met a group of guys. I watched them box first. They were from the Royal Navy, Royal Marines boxing. Well, I was thinking of joining the army because of the situation regarding my father. You know, I needed to get out. Maybe it was a shithouse way to get away from him and leave me poor mum and, you know, my family to deal with it. But also a great opportunity for me because as a kid I used to have a little plastic diver in a bottle. I don't know whether you used to have them. And turn the bottle upside down, a diver used to go to the top and go right down. I used to watch Thunderbird, you know, Thunderbird 4 was me best in that. You know, I loved heroes and, you know, I've always wanted to be a hero. But you realise all heroes are dead. So, where were we?
Joining the Navy.
Oh, right. Yeah, so I was going to join the Army to like, you know, and I told the Navy lads, you know, that's what I was going to do. And they said, why don't you join the Navy? So, I gave that a thought and I went and joined the Navy. I split up with my girlfriend at the time, Debbie Bell. And I thought I was going to join the Navy. I joined the Navy, got to HMP Rally, HMP, HMS, that used to be HMPs, HMS Rally, the training centre for the Royal Navy and Royal Marines. And after 2 weeks, I was called to the Commander-in-Chief, who was like the, you know, the head of the establishment. And it was a difficult time, the training, the basic training. It was a really difficult time. It was hard, you know, because you come away from home. I was quite fortunate because I've done, like, weekends away with the Northwest boxing team and things like that, you know. And so I was quite used to it, but there was lads there that, you know, struggled. So I brought everyone together, like, the leadership qualities that I've got. Obviously, I became the class leader. But the Commander-in-Chief said, would you like to represent the ship in the ABA Boxing Championships? And obviously, they had the Royal Navy already up there, established middleweight. Sorry. All right, Dad! They already had the established middleweight, who was someone I aspired to be like. It was a guy called Steve Willis. Yeah, from Timoth, Steve. Cracking fighter. And he was their number one middleweight. So obviously, going up there as the new guy and whatever. It was just like a different world. This establishment in Portsmouth called HMS Nelson, where I met all the boxing team and that. Brilliant. Cliff Story, Roy Greenacre, heavyweight. Cliff Story was from Stoke, flyweight. Wayne Green, Paul Kelly. These are like, I aspire to be like these people, you know what I mean? Andy Gill. These are like all great fighters from the Royal Navy. And I thought, well, you know, they've got great coaches. I'm going to join the Royal Navy. So I went into the Royal Navy, like you say, and then I went to the championships and I got beat by Steve Willis.
Okay.
But I give a good account of myself, so much so that Steve Willis also went on to turn pro after that, and so I took over his spot.
Were your heroes as a kid and as a teenager, were they boxers or footballers or both?
Well, John Conte was the...
Was he, yeah?
Was the one that inspired me to... Well, the one... The very first time I seen the boxing was the Finnegan brothers.
Okay.
Chris and Kevin Finnegan in the Olympics. Do you remember that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wasn't around then, but yeah.
Oh, wasn't you? And we were in my great-granddad's house, my great-granddad, Peter, yeah, granddad Peter, yeah, and he got these boxing gloves for me and my brother. My brother's always been a lot bigger than me, a lot heavier than me. Brother battered me and he said, you won't make it, but he will. And I always wanted to prove him wrong. Yeah. And I did, although to this day I still hold my hands up and say my brother was a lot better boxer than me.
Was he?
Yeah. He, just natural, my brother John. Yeah.
In the 1981 ABAs you beat Tony Feal in what Boxing News described as the event of the night.
Oh, that's nice of them. Tony Feal. Well, it was my first ABA final, and I don't think you could get anyone as fit as me when I was boxing as an amateur.
Well, on that same bill, there was Errol Christie, Terry Marsh, who beat Chris Pyatt, John Lyon and Keith Wallace. So it was a good, talented crop.
Yeah, brilliant crop. Well, bring back some memories there.
And in 1982, so a year later, you were beaten by Jimmy Price, who went on to win the Commonwealth.
Jimmy Price! Me mate Jimmy. Jim, you know I beat you that night. Well, it was the luck of the draw. You know, I got drawn against Jimmy Price. I mean, I'd like to have met him in the final. It was 1982, and I can actually tell you, it was the 4th of April, 1982. Or the 2nd of April, was it? I forget my own son's birthday. Anyway, my wife Dawn went into labour, and she was in labour for 3 days.
Oof.
Yeah, and she wasn't very well at the time, and she had a lot of personal issues as well. And it was our firstborn, and I stayed with her right through. Obviously, I have to make the weight, as you know. It's difficult making the weight, 11 stone, 11, 6'2.5". And I stayed with her for them 3 days. Went straight to Gloucester. We had the weigh-in and that. I thought I fought a great fight. I put him down a couple of times. I caught him with some good digs. And I enjoyed fighting Jimmy, to be honest. I didn't think I'd give a good account of myself, but I did. And unfortunately, it was the Commonwealth year.
Right.
So we tried to come back as a light heavy. They were thinking about taking a light middle and a light heavy, and rather than take me as a light heavy, they took a light middleweight from the Royal Navy called Nicky Grooms, who now lives in Australia. Nicky, nice lad. All right, Nicky, down under. And that was really disappointing for me, especially the traumatic time I'd gone through, you know, with my wife having a baby and she was in labour for 3 days.
Well, at the time, so Boxing News described you as a clearance diver for the Royal Navy, England International, who had a solid punch, and you were married with a baby. So you literally, it was a newborn.
Yeah.
Yeah. A clearance diver, what was that like? Interesting gig?
Exceptional. I mean, if I can't really describe how difficult it was to become a Royal Navy diver, my clearance diver. And again, you know, I've come through some great things in my life. You know, when I look back, I had some great friends, made some great people. We've done some tough times, took many chances, many risks, which you've got to in that job. You know, it's like mine disposal. You know, it is what it is, explosives, you know.
At this point, your mum must be exceptionally proud. You're an England international who's got a good career in the Navy.
Well, as I said earlier, my mum had a really difficult life.
But she must have been pleased to be seeing you getting on.
Well, that was the whole idea of me being a boxer, you know, was to make her proud of me. It was the whole idea of me going to the Royal Navy to make her proud of me. Obviously, my family proud of me. But more so my mum, you know, she was my world.
Yeah. Boxing News picked you to beat Tyrone Forbes. And again, it was a cliffhanger and the best fight on the card. You were caught cold and dropped in the first 3 seconds.
1983. I can't remember that punch. Yeah, Tyrone, yeah. What a character. I was like doing really well. I was finishing everyone off in the first round, all the way up to the final. And you get 2 weeks in between each individual round of the ABAs. And the final's a 3 week break. So my weight came down the week before. And then went up on the day of the weigh-in, and I had to train at the scales, and there's already nothing of me, like I said, you know. And what we used to do was stand outside Wembley with your two free vouchers, and like when my family come down, because don't forget, I'm in the Royal Navy in Portsmouth,
yeah,
and my family's from Liverpool, so when all my family and friends come down on the coach to watch me at Wembley, I'm standing outside with the two free tickets in my tracksuit, to hand it to my family, get two in, go back out, get two in. That's the way it was. Proper scousers, you know what I mean? and we'd all like pile in at the end of the fight at Wembley into the hotel room and just all sleep where you sleep, if so to speak. Those were great times then.
It's amazing that you went to the 1984 Olympics just as an achievement in Los Angeles. And, you know, people remember that as the Carl Lewis Olympics, obviously, when he got four golds. But also the Americans had an extraordinarily talented team, of which you were unfortunate to meet one of them, Virgil Hill.
Yeah, Virgil Hill, yeah. Yeah, it was unfortunate. I actually had a bye through the first round.
So you were doing well.
I got through, yeah. I got through to the second round, yeah. It was just one of the things. I mean, I suppose if it had had a fight beforehand and got rid of the ring rust, you know, I mean,
and
I don't know.
And all the rest of it, big fight, occasion, nerves.
Massive occasion, you know, and like.
And Virgil's not bad. I mean, he's an international boxing Hall of Famer now. He's gone on to win world titles and everything else.
He's not bad.
Yeah, he's all right, isn't he?
I think he holds the record, and it won't ever be beat for the most
defenses. Yeah. At light heavy, yeah.
Yeah, he's an absolutely excellent boxer. I never had much time to speak to him. I was so disappointed in my performance, to be honest, because I really had high expectations of myself, and I really believed I could beat him when I seen him fight in his first fight. I thought I had the handle of him. I thought I could beat him. You know, I thought he's not much. But then you realise the rustiness, he's probably getting rid of his rust, you know what I mean? In that first fight, I think he was quite fortunate. Yeah.
So he beat you 5-0, but Boxing News said it was closer than that. Did you know that he was destined for big things when you fought him? Did you think he would go on to achieve everything that he did? Because like I said, he's a Hall of Fame fighter.
I thought I was going to go on to be better than I was.
Do you think he was? Did you think you were going to be better than he was?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. I'd love to have fought him again, yeah.
Was there pressure on you being the captain of the team?
In a way, I remember. I mean, don't forget, we're talking 1984. Don't forget, we're all just young lads. Well, I was 24, like. I was the captain of the team. And it was the biggest ever team that they've ever sent to an Olympics, I think. 12 strong.
Right.
From flyweight, light flyweight up to super heavyweight. Can I name them? John Lyon, John Ireland, Kevin Taylor, Mickey Hughes, Rod Douglas, me. Tony Wilson, Dougie Young, Bobby Wells, Alex Dixon, and Pat Clinton.
Memory's still there.
Well, two things happen to you when you box for a long time. Just the two things, you know, like, obviously, all the punches and that, you know, to your head. And the first thing is, like, you know, your memory goes, and you start forgetting things, you know. And the second thing is, your memory goals, you start forgetting things.
I was ready for that.
Someone's jumped the gun for that.
I telegraphed that, mate. I saw it. You didn't hide it behind the jab.
I always that. Get people talking about me. I mean, as an England international and the England captain, obviously the baptism's quite good. We used to get people getting dressed in the England shorts and vest and the boxing gloves. We'd all be waiting in the reception in the hotel room the night before the fights and that. And claim that we were a news reporter, come down in the kit, you know, and we'd get them all come down in the kit, you know, like in the lift, and we'd all be sitting there going, get on him.
But you know, you talked about such a harrowing upbringing. By this point, you've really turned your life around. You're the captain of England. You're in the Navy. Mm. You're about to go pro. Like that, the childhood is a distant memory, right?
No, it's never a distant memory. I did use it to push myself, you know.
Motivate, yeah.
Yeah, because I come from nothing.
Yeah. Why did it take you 2 years to turn pro after the Olympics?
I was in the Royal Navy.
Right.
And I kind of got blackmailed out of the Royal Navy.
To go pro?
No, it's... I was in the Falklands, and had incidents there, you know, ended up getting a bit of trouble fighting again. See, once I had the confidence and the will, you know, I wouldn't back down to no one. Didn't fear anything or anyone. I still don't. And I fear, obviously, the authorities, especially the manipulation and the exploitation and the use of me, you know. Yeah, when you get a bit of a name and a reputation for you, like King of the Hill, and everybody wants to have a pop at you. And the more diplomatic I find, you think it's a weakness. And when you do stand up for yourself, I mean, I've took digs off people for no reason. I've took bottles, chairs, stools, you name it, hammers, stabbed in the neck, stabbed in the arse, stabbed in the leg, slashed on the back. And when I've stood up for myself, I'm getting a name and a reputation, and I don't want the name and the reputation, I just want to get on with my life and make people smile, and that's all I've ever done, is try and make people smile. Like I said to you, as a kid, I had no friends and that, and I love making people. I'm a bit of a people pleaser, I suppose.
I can see that, even now, just spending the first hour or so with you today.
All right, nice one, thanks. But you haven't laughed.
Put a smile on my face. I've been smiling inside. Was it hard to adapt to civilian life coming out of the forces?
Yeah, I think that was a really big transition for me.
Because we hear about that a lot now after the Gulf War, and now obviously with people coming back from Afghanistan, we've got Help for Heroes, which is gets a lot of headlines and that kind of stuff. But back then, there wasn't really as much bridging, was there?
I think how I first come together was in the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy Boxing Squad, you know, like I say, we had the England international coaches, you know, we had the best coaches, Mickey Schoen, you know, brilliant, Tony Oxley, oh, magnificent, Alan Dorman, Tony Bevel, Mickey Garrity, Pony Moore, oh my God, so many great coaches, all England international coaches, and my bed was well and truly made, if you know what I mean. It was great, you know, we fitted in just well. But obviously, being a Royal Navy diver and such a hot job, really, you know, they never had many Royal Navy Mark Lennox divers, you know, it was a really big thing. So they wanted me to go to the Falklands and clear mines on the beaches and do jobs on ships and subs and things like that. And you know, they only had two pubs there. One was called, one was a community, a conservative club, and one was called The Globe on Port Stanley. Well, we were actually in Navy Point, which is a little island facing. We had to get a little ferry across. It was like the size of the Mersey, you know what I mean, to Birkenhead. And so when we used to come over to the pub there, as a team, a Navy diving team, obviously there's not many girls on the island, you know, and next minute I just heard, "Shooey!" And it was some girl, Julie, from the NAFI and HMS Nelson, remembered me, you know, and she said, she was with these girls, so she brought these girls over to our company. And obviously there's that many sex-starved, hungry men in there, and they say, "Why, they've got that," you know, and she said, "He went to the Olympics," you know, and all this, so I was all right. My pals were all right, but then all these big Royal Marines, big beefy lads were all getting angry, you know what I mean? I'm saying, "Whoa!" And it was a bit of trouble and ended up getting flown back. Unfortunately, someone got injured badly. There's a lot of responsibility being a boxer, and, you know, all these coping strategies, I think people need to be more aware of them, you know, and how to deal with anger issues. If you've got anger issues, go and get it seen to. You don't know you've got anger issues. Someone might tell you. Listen to them. Go and speak to someone, please, before you get yourself in trouble like I did.
So, did you leave the Navy on your own accord, or did you have to leave?
Well, like I say, I got flown back from the Falklands, and the day I got flown back, it was my birthday. And I'm up in Nelson Bop, it was called. It was a disco, and there was a bit of trouble in there. And I helped the regulators, like the Navy Police, to resolve this issue. and I actually ended up getting charged with fighting with another sailor, and I never fought with him. I just helped the reggies who were on my side, but I think they already had an in for me. And then something went on where I had to do a punishment, number nines. That meant I had to stay on base, couldn't go ashore and do extra duties. It's called number nine punishment. However, I had a friend who was a POPTI who was going for his chief's PTI, which took a lot of years to accomplish.
Yeah.
Great fella. I don't want to mention names. Anyway, he said, come and work in my place, which was a shore base, just outside the shore base I was in, and you can go and do what you want. So I used to go into town, and the regulators pulled up one day in the van and said, you're going to have to get back on camp. They've got a midships woman, which is a young officer, doing rounds, and she's checked your pit, and you're not in your pit. Anyway, I got nicked for it, and tried to make up some kind of concoction to cover me back by involving my girlfriend at the time, a girl called Gail Wren. And so we pretended that we fell asleep in the boxing gym and that. And I was called in front of the commander, and he said, you've got an option, you know, you signed to leave the Navy, or if you want to fight this, you're going to get two people in trouble. We're going to demote PO, oh, nearly give his name away then, PO,
whoever PTI, he was,
and he's going for his chiefs, and we're going to demote him to a leading seaman, unless you sign this and go, and we're going to also get rid of Wren. That was the girl I was seeing, Gail Wren. And so I left.
And that was that?
Yeah. So I was more or less blackmailed out of it.
So you turned to boxing as a pro. You won your first fight. I think it was up in Halifax. You beat Jeff Reimer.
Jeff Reimer, I fought him. He was, I think he won numerous of titles, Jeff Junior, ABAs and schoolboys. And he was, he'd been around a while, I think, Jeff. I didn't see him as a pro until I fought him. Obviously, I was a bit, because I was fought him in 1979 as an amateur.
Right.
In the Northern Counties final, and I beat him then.
You beat him in 90 seconds in the pros.
Did I, yeah.
And Boxing News called it a stunning right cross that did it. And then a couple of weeks later, you were again the quickest winner of the night, stopping tough Blaine Logston, who was...
Alan Newton.
And that was in 70 seconds in round two in Alfreton.
Yeah, I was a bit disappointed there, to be honest, because, like, I hit him with some shots. Like, I mean, he took some digs. I mean, I've fought some very strong people in my time, and I've hit them with some shots. And I just think, how are you still standing?
Yeah. You beat Alan Price in Leeds. You knocked him out. Yeah. How hard was it to adapt to the pros from the amateurs? Nowadays, they sort of seem, the lines seem to be blurred with the longer rounds and no head guard, and there's more acceptance of a professional style in amateur boxing.
I think that's why I did turn pro, because they actually brought in the head guards in 1984, I think it was, when we went to the Olympics. And I just thought, you can't fight with them. You're just making the target bigger. You're just getting caught with silly shots all the time. You know, and to say that you know it stops you from getting injured, you know, cuts and black eyes. I'd never wore a head guard before until I boxed Virgil Hill in the Olympics. And I come out with two black eyes and a broken nose. You know, and...
Well, that's Virgil Hill. That's not the head guard doing that.
Oh, well, you know, he was making the target bigger, wasn't he? You know, I think we should have had more time with head guards. But I wouldn't spar with a head guard, never mind. You know, I've had a lot of fights, and I've had no side effects.
No. You stopped fellow Liverpool man Malcolm Kay in Oldham. That was on the Glenn McCrory, Hugo Curry bill.
Oh, yeah. Molly Kay. What a warrior. Molly Kay, salute you, sir. Yeah, what a warrior. Dug deep, the fella, and obviously that finished. What round was that? Third round, was it?
Yeah, I think it was. But Boxing News then said that you've been thrown in at the deep end against Ian Lazarus. That was for the Central Area title.
Yeah. Oh, well, Ian Lazarus was a guy who'd been in with, you know, tough pros, Yowie Davis, Dennis Andres, at the time, Tom Collins and that, and never been put on his ass. You know, and I worked alongside a guy called, we only had a couple of weeks' notice for the fight again, by the way. Billy Hardy, his name right. was, whose two sons fight, Fran Arden and Paul Arden, two good friends of mine. And Billy, we trained on throwing a right hook over the top because he was, I thought he was very susceptible to it. And the idea was to beat him, and I beat him in the first round. In fact, when we were coming out with the Central Area title belt, all his entourage were trying to come in and pay in. Right, you're going to get it tonight, they were saying, you're going to get it. I said, lads, don't pay in. I said, he's beat, it's gone, it's over. I'm on my way home, see you later.
Well, you could see your scouse humour then, because you said afterwards, I want to get to the top as quickly as possible, but I didn't think he'd go as fast as that.
No, I didn't.
52 seconds.
Yes. Yeah. I obviously caught him cold. And that was the idea. It was good.
You were put down by Azeek the Sheik Minnis from the West Indies. That was in Alphington on a Bill U headline. Was that the first time you'd been dropped?
No, I'm always getting put on my arse. You know. I think it takes a fighter to get up and fight on, you know. I'm always getting put on my ass. he was an awkward customer. He was like a Robbie Davis kind of punch, you know, the overarm right hands and things like that. Delroy Parks fought the same way as him. He was from the RAF, good lad. Yeah, so I beat him and I was a bit naughty afterwards, I suppose. I think it was just in the heat of the moment and the adrenaline rushing like it does.
So what did you do? What did you do afterwards?
After...
You said you were a bit naughty afterwards.
Yeah, I made a nasty sign, you know, with my head on the top of his head when he picked me up.
Right.
You know, I'll never get out, you know, I'll still come to terms with that. I mean... These are fighters, these are warriors. We're fighters, we're warriors. We should be respecting each other, you know what I mean? I mean, I know there's a lot of animosity before a fight. And, you know, I've fought a few friends, you know, and you've got to dig deep. I mean, I remember fighting, broke my heart, a guy called Jim Peters.
Right.
You know, maybe Jim was an amateur from Southampton. Him and his dad, Joe, and his brother, Joe. We're all friends. He used to come and spar with us with the Royal Navy team and that. And I had to, I think it was 1983 actually, and I had to, in English semis, and I had to beat him, you know what I mean, from Paul. And you know, there's no love lost between that, and his dad got a bit upset with me, and they never spoke to me again ever since, and it kind of broke my heart. Lovely people who were, lovely people. I've met some beautiful people in my sport, and I'm privileged to have met these people, you know. Some lovely people. Obviously you get your wolves and your arseholes and that, but you know, I think the good people far outweigh the bad people.
You beat John Joe Green in an untidy fight.
John Joe Green, an untidy fight, is that what it is?
Yeah. Well, it was scrappy, wasn't it? I think it was saying that he tried to headbutt you a lot.
No, he didn't try. He bloody succeeded. Never kept his head out of my face. He was so clever, John. He was a lovely man as well. Yeah.
And then you fought on the Terry Marsh world title bill in Basildon. You beat Mike Aubrey.
Mick Aubrey, yeah. Yeah, from Canvey Island. He was a good prospect, Mick. And that was a bit of an untidy fight for me. I don't know whether the occasion got to me, you know, being in the tent with Terry Marsh. I mean, Terry was a mate of mine for a long, long time, you know, with the Royal Navy boxing team, Royal Marines boxing team. And England international. In fact, I'd say he was one of my biggest idols, Terry Marsh.
Yeah.
Excellent fighter. There's another guy, Paul Kelly. You know, I mean, we had some great talent in the Royal Navy boxing team.
You then beat a young upstart called Johnny Nelson, who was 4-3 at the time. You got off the floor to do it, and he showed flashes of what he'd later do, because he was awkward. He showed that he was awkward even then. Did you know that Johnny was awkward going into that fight? He was four wins, three losses.
Well, I was winning 10 out of 10 at the time. And I was going through a bit of a difficult time with my manager. And in fact, I hadn't trained for a long time. We'd fallen out. But he still had me under contract for a while. And I think it was under 2 weeks' notice I got for that fight. And when I spoke to the people from the Northwest Boxing Fraternity, you know, it was Trevor Callaghan was the promoter at the time, Jack was there, loads of people on the door saying, why is Warren putting you in with this guy? He's from the Who Needs Him Club, obviously the Brendan Ingalls stable is the Who Needs Him Club. I mean, they're so awkward, brilliant, absolutely class. I mean, I love the Brendan Ingalls stable, to be honest. I thought it was brilliant. God bless him. God rest his soul. What a man. And it was really difficult for me time. And my wife was having our second kid at the time. And I just decided to return home.
You didn't fight for nearly a year after that.
Well, he said after that fight, when I shouted my mouth off about him on the TV, not that the viewers got to see all the interview, because I swore quite a lot, a few expletives, and I absolutely destroyed Warren with me words.
You said you were going to retire.
Yeah, I should have. But, you know, when an opportunity comes, it was a year, Warren said I wasn't ready for nothing and all this, and then I never heard from him, and I started working on the door, started getting in difficulties with other things, you know, like obviously boxing on the TV. Working on the door, you're a bit of a target, you know, and I got people that used to test the water with me all the time, and, you know, if they weren't physical, I could handle it. But if they come physical, I've got to stand up for myself. And then that led to a lot of issues with Merseyside police and, well, the police in general, and got myself a bit of a bad name and reputation. Obviously, having that bad name and reputation, you always get people that want to have a pop at you, you know, because you're a boxer, being on the TV. All the birds want to get into your knickers. You know, it was some good times and some bad times. And
you wear knickers, did you? Did you wear knickers?
Did I? And I actually never know. I never.
You returned after that year out. You beat Dave Owens in 97 seconds. So a lot of quick wins going on.
Dave Owens, journeyman, yeah. It was on the Tony Simpson bill, and I think Nigel Benn fought the Indian then, wasn't it? Didn't he fight an Indian or something? Forgot his name. Come in with a big
headdress.
Yeah, headdress on, yeah.
And then a couple of weeks later, you beat Winston Burnett in Scotland. Then came your first loss. You were on the cover of Boxing News, and the headline was, Wilson storms back in a cracker. You were teammates and roommates with Tony Wilson, weren't you? How close were you guys?
Really close, me and Tony.
And he's the first guy to beat you in the pros?
He was the first guy to beat me in the pros. Was working on as a doorman, like I say, and I had a lot of things going on with Merseyside Police. And I don't know if you've been in trouble yourself or you've actually appeared in court or anything. It's one of the most traumatic experiences you could ever wish for, going to court. You know, you're a naughty boy. I've never been a naughty boy. I've always been a good boy. You know, naughty. In the end, regarding my marriage and that, you know, I just lost my way.
You put Tony down in the first round.
Yeah.
This was for the British title.
Yeah, well, like I say, I was working as a doorman and I hadn't been training, and what had happened was is that I've sparred Tony since we were 17 years old. I know I was capable of beating him. Obviously, the physicality wasn't there because I hadn't been training. Mentally, I was a bit destroyed. Emotionally, I was all over the place. Financially, I was absolutely destroyed. You know, and everything, things have got to be right in your mind when you're fighting. You know, and I don't think I ever had it right in my mind as a pro. I never really trained. I had no one to spar with. I never sparred anyone. I think Sammy Reeson was the last time I sparred, and that was early on in my pro career.
Boxing News called it an all-action war that would have graced one of the major London venues and deserved to be seen by a much larger audience than the couple of hundred present at what was promoter Frank Warren's first show at the Baths. That was Daniel Herbert reporting for Boxing News at the Municipal Hall in Tottenham.
Right.
So it was a great fight then, by all accounts.
Well, do you reckon it was a great fight? Like I say, my career had finished. And
well, it was Boxing News' fight of the year as well.
It?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I actually was at working on the door and I was on charges and I went up with a group of lads from the area. I was invited to go and watch John Ireland box Billy Hardy up in Sunderland for the British title. And John Ireland, like my really good friend, we grew up together. He's like me little soulmate, you know, he's like a little brother with me. Him and his wife Margie, beautiful people. Well, I went up to see him fight with Billy Hardy with a few of the lads from the area in Toxteth. And as we were coming away from the show, there was a guy that used to write for the Daily Express called Bryn Davis. I don't know if you remember Bryn.
Yeah, I know.
A nice man, Bryn, and he said, good luck for next month. I said, what do you mean? Good luck for next month. He said, you're fighting Tony Wilson for the British title. I said, no. No one's told me nothing. He said, I can assure you, Brian, you're fighting Tony Wilson for the British title. And about a week later, I got a letter through, say, come down to London and sign these papers. You're fighting for the British title. This was like one of his aides, Mr. McCarthy. And I went down there, signed the papers and that. And I thought I had a good chance against Tony because I know the measure of him, you know what I mean? I know I could have beat him, but obviously I never had enough time and I never trained and I wasn't writing mentally, physically, emotionally, financially again.
Well, I saw as well, when you had a rematch 7 months later, he'd had two fights in the interim and you were inactive.
Oh, was that right, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, what happened was he rated it one of the best fights ever and I took it at very short notice. So I think it was in the May, that was. I think it might have been in May. And then, obviously, you're going through the summer and on these charges. Believed to get not guilty, you know, and prove me innocent and say I've only acted in self-defence.
What were these charges? Nightclub stuff?
A lot of assaults, yeah. A lot of assaults. And it was me that was actually assaulted, you know. That's what the frustrating thing about it is. You know, or my wife at the time, Debbie, yeah. So, getting back to the Wilson fight, and we never had, obviously, never sparred no one, never trained no one. And I couldn't capitalise on the first knockdown. I think I tried to, because I think it was my only shot. And I was absolutely shattered. He hit me with about 14 or 15 left hooks. And they weren't hurting me, I was just taking it and taking it. Just about to set my attack, I was absolutely shattered, to be honest. And the referee stepped in and stopped the fight. I had a little nick on my eye. I never heard from Frank Warren's office again. That was May. I'd phone him about two, three times a day again. No, I've only lost one fight. I mean, I've had 11 fights, I've lost one now. No, British title fight. So it doesn't look too bad on your record. But what people didn't really understand was I was on this fast bus, couldn't get off it. I was gone. Then I got a phone call the 12th of January. From Lesley McCarthy again. He said, I've got a fight for you, Brian. I said, who is he? He said, Lesley McCarthy. I said, oh, I said, I've been phoning. He said, you only had to ask for me or for Frank. I said, who do you think I was asking for, the Queen Mother? You know, so he said, I've got a fight for you, Brian. 24th of January. I said, 12 days' time. You're having a laugh. I haven't seen for months. He said, Brian, just take this at light heavy. They're bringing this new weight in called super middleweight. I promise you. And we will get you that. That'll shoot you down to the ground. We'll start looking after you, blah, blah, and all this. And I thought, nah. He said, look, Brian, I'll give you £2,000 in your hand. I said, nah. I'm not fit. I said, I haven't trained. He said, Brian, we're not worried about you fighting that light heavy anymore. This new, we promise you we'll start looking after you and all that. So I took the fight. and I was too busy looking for Frank Warren at the ringside to just give him a mouthful, to be honest, and I got told off by the referee a few times.
Yeah, so Mickey Van apparently warned you for talking to someone outside the ring. You remember that?
Mr. Warren, yeah. As soon as I took my eyes off the ball, bang! Good night, Vienna.
8 months later, you got a late call to fight James Cook. Slugger O'Toole had pulled out with a kidney issue. You started well against James Cook, who was a great fighter.
I started well against James Cook, did I?
Yeah.
I don't even remember that fight, to be honest.
8 months later, you got a late call to fight James Cook. Slugger O'Toole had pulled out with a kidney issue, and apparently you started well against Cook, but he got you in the fifth round. James Cook was an exceptional fighter as well.
I got to agree that he is an exceptional fighter, but I can honestly say with my hand on my heart, if I was fit that night, I would have beat James. I got 24 hours notice for the fight. I hadn't trained for months. All I've done is gone to the gym the day when I got the call, and there's two coaches there, Franny Hans and John Cannon, my old coaches, and Franny Hans is an ex-boxer as well, a brilliant man. Anyway, he said, what are you doing here? I said, just right into the sauna, just to make the weight. He said, I said, I'm fighting tomorrow. He said, you haven't trained for months? I said, just going to make the weight and get in there. He said, you're having a laugh, aren't you? So obviously, I said, well, if you don't go in the corner, I said, I'll pay someone else for it. You know what I mean? I'll just get someone else, some other, give them a wage, pay your train fare and your hotel and that, you know. So we travelled down the next day. Obviously, I can't eat or drink and that, you know, just gargle water, spit out like the norm, taking laxatives and all that to make the weight. And it was a journey and a half. It was to Basingstoke, I think it was Basingstoke, was it?
Possibly, yeah.
It was a bit of a journey, and then we had to
go from Basingstoke into London.
We had to go to London, obviously, and then go to Basingstoke. And then from Basingstoke, we had to go to Harley Street, you know, to see the doctor to get a brain scan. And I left my bag. I have to have a special gum shield because I've got no front teeth. These are false. I have to have a really particular special gum shield made. And that was in my bag with the rest of my stuff and that. Anyway, we left everything there in the changing rooms. And when we come back, my gum shield was missing, so much so that when I was gloved up and that, ready to go get my gum shield, it's not there. What do you mean it's not there? Turned it upside down, it's not there. And obviously, I'm not pointing any fingers like, but I think someone had a little dabble and took it. So I've got my gloves on now, ready to go in the ring, no gum shield. So they had to use one of them pound ones, you know, the little mouldy ones you put. So we got some hot water and just stuck in my mouth. Yeah. Just kept dropping every time we flicked. James Cook, wasn't mad, James, lovely man. Like to meet up with him again soon. He just hit me with everything and I just... My face was in a mess. But I thought, I could beat this fella, you know. Every time he hit me, the gum shield just kept dropping, you know what I mean? So then it was a counter punch, you know.
This is a rough run of fights, because then you fight Crawford Ashley.
Yeah, yeah. How long ago after that was that?
Let me see. Where are we? So James Cook was September 1989, and Crawford Ashley was January 1990. So 4 months.
4 months, yeah. Yeah, I took that at 2 weeks' notice as well. I thought I could beat Crawford, to be honest, but unfortunately, it never worked.
He was a vicious puncher, wasn't he, Crawford Ashley?
Can't remember. Also, I was so disappointed. A little nick on my eye, you know, but I just wasn't there.
So it seems to be a theme, because Boxing News said that you came in at late notice to fight John Foreman, who was due to face Roy Skeldon. But Roy had broken his hand 5 days out, and you got 48 hours notice to fight John Foreman.
Yeah, I was probably partying then, and probably went straight from a party to fight John Foreman.
Well, that was your last fight. You were stopped in four rounds.
I was stopped in four rounds? I don't even remember, to be honest. It was a good party, wasn't it? That's the way life ended for me, and like you say, I was on a self-destruct mission. But obviously, having tried to contemplate and look back at life, it was obviously a depression, you know, and I realise that now. But I mean, how the bloody hell am I supposed to go and say, oh, I'm depressed, you know what I mean? How do you explain that? I was scared. There was a lot of hostility in the area at the time. A pal of mine got shot dead. A lot of things got... It was a hectic few years. And then, obviously, I ended up where I ended up.
On holiday?
On holiday.
You.
It wasn't much of a holiday, you know, getting...
So what did you go down for the first time?
I was involved in a fracas in the club where I worked.
Okay.
These Hulkamania, they were called, like big Chippendale guys. And one of them got a cut to his face and said it was me. But it wasn't. There was like 80 people involved, but the only person who wanted it was me, the police. And never charged anyone else with it. There was loads involved.
So the story, obviously, that's done the rounds infamously now for over the last few years was that you were you did a long stretch for killing your mum's
partner. Yeah,
was that right?
I've done almost 23 years in prison. Yeah,
and was that what it was for?
Yeah, I killed my mum's partner. Yeah,
did you mean to do that?
Of course not. If I wanted to hurt him, I would have punched his head in, but I didn't even want to hurt our Peter, you know. His family, you know what I mean? He was my, yeah. He was my confidence, you know. I could go talk to him, you know, when I was in my depression modes and that. He's my mum's soulmate. And I told her I wanted to make my mum proud of me, you know. And now all of a sudden I'm a fucking big slob who's abusing himself in his own selfish, which is depression, which is the most selfish thing going. I was actually asleep on the couch. And I don't really want to go into detail because I don't want to be upsetting my victim's family or my family again. I don't want to be really stirring it up. But it was an accident. However, the police created a scenario and failed to give me solicitor full disclosure, although I did tell me solicitor right from the very beginning what had happened, but I had no alternative but to go with his advice because apparently we had no evidence to back my side of the story. But we did, or we could have if they'd have tried harder. But with the scenario the police had created, it turned everyone against me and everyone was believing that I must have beat him up. Yeah, Peter never had a cut lip or a cut nose or a black eye or anything. He was 5'5", 5'6", 9 stone wet. Look, the size of my fist would break his bloody head, you know what I mean? I wouldn't punch Peter. However, they found me guilty on circumstantial evidence. But the way they done it was quite ruthless, quite malicious. I'm disgusted.
Was it something where you were told to plead murder rather than manslaughter?
Yeah, there was no manslaughter put to us. There was no manslaughter put to us. I explained to me brief exactly what happened and what time it happened. However, there was discrepancies between the time and because they had a surety time at 11:22 from a pub, where pubs only served till 10 o'clock on a Sunday, back in 1996. I went away to prison and I've journeyed all over the country in 23 different prisons, probably on every wing.
When you got sentenced, how long did you get sentenced for that?
Well, the judge, in his summing up, said, Mr. Schumacher is a man of a hard man, hero figure status in the city. He uses his speed, skill and ability to dominate and recommend a tariff of 15 years, which is reduced to 13. However, you can't go until they say you're ready to go, and it was 18 and a half years before they let me to the hostel. I was in the hostel for a while, and I was recalled because someone reported me for behaving poorly, although no one's thrown their hands up to say what the poor behaviour was.
So were you a bad... Were there points in your life where you've been a bad guy?
They tried to paint me as a bad guy, but everyone that knows me knows them more. I've never involved myself in crime. I've always been proud of that fact. You know, and I've looked back and I think, you know, maybe I should have got myself involved in crime. I'd be a lot better off than living in this bloody hostel, you know.
What's this, like a halfway house?
This is a hostel. This is the fourth one I've been in since I've been released. It holds 63 different rooms. So you can imagine the noise, and overnight it's like being in prison, especially with this lockdown and people coping with their own depression and strategies. Coping strategies aren't very good, they're all negative, you know, well, the majority are, and but the vast majority, drinking and taking drugs and things, you know.
You know, there's really not much about you online, which I know obviously you were active as a fighter a while ago, but there's normally loads on anybody, but there's not much about you. But I found a few bits, so let me just check these with you. Someone wrote, I was in Gurf prison with him in 2004 to 2005. He was in the pad across from me. Great bloke and makes everyone laugh with his everyday antics. Screws feel intimidated by him, so they keep moving him on when he gets settled. He lost privileges and was banged up during association time only for him to have a table outside his cell door with his mate holding his cards playing poker. Very good memories of Shuey.
Yeah. Well,
is that true?
I think everyone does wrong in their life. I mean, if you haven't made mistakes in your life, I think you're lying, you know what I mean? And I've had that spirit to try and pick people's spirit up. I know people have done a lot of wrongs, but you know, it's all about forgiveness at the end of the day. And if you can't forgive people, you won't be able to forgive yourself. You know, so I always forgive people, and a bit disappointed and disillusioned with so many people's behaviour and that, but you know, we all make mistakes. So I just used to have a laugh, you know. I'm sure there's a lot more stories than that people could tell you. I mean, I think that's why they kept me in there, because I entertained.
Well, there was one that says, hope he gets out soon. Apparently he had a bust up with his stepfather, hit him and he died. Easy done for a fellow of his size and power. And that's the kind of norm, that's kind of what the story was.
Oh yeah, well, let me just get this straight. My victim was very special to me, my family, and especially no one more than my mother. She absolutely adored Peter absolutely adored my mother. I was so grateful for the love that he had for her. He was an alcoholic, had cirrhosis of the liver, and unfortunately he died from a broken rib, split his liver in two. I actually kicked him with my foot. It's a long story, I don't really want to go into it on camera.
Sure.
Like, I don't want to be distressing anybody.
How did it affect the relationship with your mum?
How did it affect the relationship with my mum? Obviously, it was quite strained. Why didn't you ask for manslaughter? I said, you can't ask for manslaughter, Mum. You've just got to get what you're given. I've got to go with the legal. No one knows the legal thing more than me. You know what I mean? You think you've got the right people in, but apparently, because they failed to disclose all the evidence, their case is put around the 11:30 mark. I know what happened at 10:30. You know, and I've explained that to me brief. That show receipt must have been out an hour. You know, he said, well, you've got no evidence to prove. I said, well, can't you do it? I'm in prison, how can I do it? You know.
How long did you end up serving for that?
Altogether?
Yeah. For that murder.
I got a 15-year tariff reduced to 13. I was out in a hostel after 18 and a half.
Right.
And I went back for another 4 years for poor behaviour, which is like an 8-year sentence. For poor behaviour.
Did you behave poorly?
No.
At meal times, you used to sit there, bang your knife and fork on the table and say, 15 years to go, 15 years to go.
Well,
true or false?
True. I just knew what the game plan was, to be honest. I knew what the game plan was.
Was prison time tough? You know, you talk about having a target on your back.
Yeah, of course it was tough.
On the
doors.
Because
if you're not having it with that firm, you're having it with that firm. If you're not having it with that firm, you must be having it with that firm. If you're having it with that firm, I don't have it. I've never involved myself in shit. Because in that game, you've got to be a two-faced backstabbing bastard. Unfortunately, mate, I'll just tell you as it is. And of course, if I'm not running with you and you want me, or I'm an obstacle to you because I don't like bullies, you know.
Did someone try and attack you with a pool ball and a sock?
Gangs? Gangs them? End up chasing them around a bleeding pool table and things like that. Yeah.
It's crazy. It's so crazy.
Well, they put you in a hostile environment. I mean, you've got to stand up for yourself.
Well, that was my next question, really. Does it rehabilitate? Did you need rehabilitation?
Well, let me tell you this. Every prisoner went to, the staff knew me or knew of me, and especially the gym staff, yet they never helped me do the courses to get the certificates for doing courses, you know, like to better yourself as a person when you come out, you know, like not more than being a coach or a gym, you know, that's what I wanted to do. I was fit. I was really fit up until I was 51, and I felt like they nobbled me in the prison with a jab, claiming it was an hepatitis B booster. But just so happened, I was actually 51 at the time. It's a long story, you'll have to get the book. And I think they nobbled me.
You appeared on this search that I did as on a forum as one of UK's scariest debt collectors.
Do you know what? I'd seen that. I phoned my brother. I said, have you ever collected debts? He said, no.
So he said that. So one thread here says, man was an absolute animal. He also defeated future world champ Johnny Nelson, but went off the rails towards the end of his career. His family consists of the Prestons and the McMullens. And I would see Paul Mack against almost any man unarmed and back into win. Unbelievable. But you, so debt collector, gangland enforcer?
Would have been nice, wouldn't it?
Would have been nice.
Well, I would, you know, I wouldn't be stuck in a bleeding hostel, would I?
But, John, this.
No car. No. I haven't even got a telly.
I can't get my head round the transition from Navy,
yeah,
England captain, mm-hmm, fighting Virgil Hill in Los Angeles, to prison and prison stories of fights and working nightclubs and stuff. I mean, it's an incredible journey, but does it feel like you had stuff and you threw it away, or does it feel like you were destined to have a tough life.
I think everyone's destined to go on their journey and cope with their journey, and I'd say just hang on in there, keep smiling. I love putting smiles on people's faces, I really do. I mean, you haven't even heard me on the karaoke yet, have you?
I dread to think. What's your best song? Special?
I do sing a song.
Not 15 years to go. It's like 10 green bottles.
Yeah, I do sing a song that I think was written about me. It's called Bohemian Rhapsody. And the man I killed was me. You know, that's the. I know it sounds a bit bad, like, you know, because I've got a victim who was convicted of murder. God bless him. And I know what happened. That's why I could live with it. It's just, it was so awful, the predicament I was put in, the unfortunate predicament, and it just turned out the way it did.
There was one more story I wanted to put to you. Did you ever beat up a comedian on stage?
I never beat him up. I was actually with my wife, Debbie. We'd be having a bit of a rough time of it, and I went with me old coach, Les McLean, to this boxing do in the Devonshire Hotel. And they had this comedian on, and my wife, my former wife Debbie, she's a proper lady, a real lovely woman. I was just a dick, and we went out, and she absolutely looks stunning. She's a beautiful woman, and she looks stunning, and I was so proud, you know, to have her on my arm. But they had this rude comedian on, and I said to her, you know, they might have strippers on at the break, or a comedian, you know, he might be a bit forward. And she said, oh, don't worry. And he come on, and I swear you'd know, he just went, as soon as he went, what the? I started, oh, what are you doing with him? And, you know, he's driving a score, it's like dragging a jam rag up the motorway, and you know, like, and I thought, and he just, I said, listen, mate, if you carry on with that, I said, I hope you've got someone to mind you when you go out. He went off. So she said, can we go to the bar? I said, well, if he says anything as we go past, I said, I'll punch his fucking lights in, the little bastard. So we walked up to the bar. No sooner did we get to the bar, nor the drinks, this fella's finished his act. So he's more or less used all his act on me. Now, this is sitting with all my nemesis, all the police. All the police are sat there, all these top regimental police and whatever. So I've gone to him as he's coming out the ring, and I said, Hey mate, I said, you've got two options, I said. You either go up, buy me drink a bit, buy me missus a drink and apologise, you know what I mean? Or you give her half your wages because you used more than half your act on her. And he went, fuck off. I fucking cracked what I said, come with me. I was trying to drag him up the stairs towards my wife, you know, come and apologise, you bastard. That's all I've done. Obviously, everyone made a big hoo-ha out of it. Some comedians used it when they went on to do boxing shows, you know, Al Jackie Hamilton, cracking comedian, Liverpool comedian. My pal was telling me he's had a boxing do. He said, Jackie Hamilton, come on, he starts. Come on, right, walking around the ring, going like, just about to do his act. Stopped here for a bit, had a little look over there. Brian Schumacher here tonight. Oh, Jackie. My old mate Stan Carnall told me that, yeah.
It's an incredible story. I can't quite grasp but how you sort of seem to have it all. And it just seemed, but you know, like you said, there was this destiny where you were just going to struggle. But what was it like in terms of the comparison between coming out of the Navy and becoming a civilian to now having been inside for so long to now being a civilian? Because when you go back to 1990, we're looking at pre any of this kit and pre cell phones, mobile phones.
Yeah, we never had mobile phones then.
Pre laptops, the whole lot.
Well, like, I haven't
the
got
world's
a clue.
Changed yeah. since you went in.
I haven't got a clue. Oh, it's changed. Changed. I'm still me. I've had an experience and a half, I suppose, on people's skills and education and that way. And I've come into my city. I've come into my city. I love the people of Liverpool. You've never met better people. Liverpool fans, Everton fans, wherever. Just beautiful people. Make you feel welcome. I go into town, honestly, people are so welcoming and that. But I want to talk to people. I like to talk, you know. I get on a train and talk and make conversation, strike conversation. Everyone's all on the phones now. Or I get on a bus, you know. My partner used to, you know, laugh her head off, you know. She said, you just get everyone talking on the bus, you know. She said, it's a good gift to have, you know what I mean? You're really gifted that way. You bring people together really well. I said, yeah, because I like people to enjoy life. I mean, life's hard enough without complications. And that's all I want to do is bring people together, but it's changed a lot.
Is it like intimidating?
Yeah, it's quite intimidating. Yeah, I think a lot of people are just out for themselves or out to pull the wool over your eyes. A lot of wolves. A lot of rats in prison, but a lot of wolves outside. There's a few wolves in prison, but not as many rats.
Did you get institutionalised?
Am I institutionalised? What's institutionalised?
Like too familiar with being inside and the routine and all the rest of it, and so that now...
doing it here.
Are you?
We're on bleeding lockdown as well.
Yeah, that's true. You know, that's true. Bad example.
My partner's just split up with me. She's had enough. Gutted. But such is life. Just got to get on with it.
Do you think you will go back in at any point? Do you worry about going back inside? Yeah.
I worry about going back inside because of what happened the last time. You just come and collected me from the room and just took me in. Never gave me any excuse, never told me nothing. You said, oh, we've just been told to arrest you. And I went back in for 4 years because of the parole hearing. It takes so long. And 4 years, like an 8-year sentence. People are not getting that for manslaughter or armed robberies, you know what I mean? So you think, should I just do one armed robbery or two? Maybe do three. I'm 60 now. Only got a few years left. Get a few quid. But it's just not my stamp. Do you know what I mean?
Do you still have that edge, like nastiness? Are you a ticking time bomb?
No, not anymore.
But you were?
I think I was, yeah.
And that stems from the childhood that we started with?
Yes, of course, yeah. Of course.
With what you know now, could you have gone down a different path? if you knew it was to do with a childhood, if you'd have like counselling and help, do you think with what you've learned over the years that things could have been different for you? That if you'd had counselling support, if you'd been able to talk about depression like people talk about it now, rather than bottle stuff up because you're the big hard man and you can't put on that front, do you think things could have been different for you?
Yeah, I think my depression started when I was in the Royal Navy boxing team, to be honest with you.
But you were happy then, seemingly. But was that because you left your mum?
I think there's quite a number of things we can put in. You know, it's about sitting down with some kind of counsellor, you know, to get it out of me, because you're not going to get me crying while I'm on here.
I've done it before. I can make people crack.
Yeah. I think, yeah, I needed help before I come out the Royal Navy. Yeah. I think the Royal Navy should have helped me more. Especially where my head was and my space was, knowing about the issues that I had when I was in the Falklands, and you know, they should have helped me more. Instead of blackmailing me to get out, maybe I was become above myself, you know, being captain of the Olympics, you know, you're a cocky little bastard, you know what I mean? And everybody all wants to have a little go at you. Well, everyone wants to all bring you down all the time. Captain of England, fuck you. Captain of Great Britain, you know what I mean? I had a photograph there at the end of the Olympics, me and Daley Thompson squaring up to each other, right? Daley Thompson, the greatest athlete ever, you know what I mean? Squaring up over the girl's phone number from the crowd in the closing ceremony in the Olympics. Seb Coe stood there separating us. Lord Coe, as he's called now. Sir Steve Redgrave stood there. And John Lyon, the most ABA titles ever. You know, like, on this photo. It got torn. Got it mended. And it's gone missing. Like Lord Coe, Sir Steve Redgrave, no one better than John Lyon from St. Helens. Wow, wow.
And Sherry.
But Daley Thompson, I don't know. And we just had some great times together, our England squad, our Great Britain squad. Just boxing all together just brings people together, and that's what I'm concerned about with life today, that years ago when we were all kids, we'd all meet in your nans, and then you go to your grandma's the next week, and then your nans to follow me. That's all stopped now, hasn't it? You know what I mean? People coming together. Well, it hasn't stopped completely, but it's really, really divided us. And like in Liverpool where we lived, all the families lived very close together, if not together. And like I said, we used to turn up every weekend. Yeah, we got moved to Heighton, away from the town. Other families got moved to Kirby, Skemmersdale, Runcorn, all these big places. So they've torn the people apart from each other and made distances and put barriers in front of people and obstacles in front of people. And relationships are breaking down because of the journey. Hopefully with phones it'll bring it back. But I think it's some kind of deliberate act that they want to divide people, you know.
Mm.
I mean, I've come out of prison after 23 years. And the oases of the city, you know, like an oasis in a desert where people go and sit and chat and swap stories and gifts and, you know, whatever.
Talk, communicate.
Yeah, you know, communicate and relate. And they've shut all the pubs down, all these oases of the city. They've shut them all down to break down the communities. And they're instilling fear by writing in the Liverpool Echo. I call it the Police Times. It just glamorises crime. Makes people look like big gangsters and big... They're not. They're just ordinary people like you and me who hit a low spot. Or they're ordinary people who are just greedy. You know, and they've split the people up and intimidating them and putting them behind the doors. And you can only go and congregate in the town centre, you know, where they've got cameras and things like... And everything. And everything's just getting fear instilled in them.
People have been afraid of you.
Yeah, and so they should.
Do you reckon? Were you a man to be feared?
Oh, I love people, me. I just love.
Yeah.
That's my ex-wife. Bloody hell. I didn't have fear to her. I'm so sorry, love. So sorry, girl. I really am. And I'm sorry to my kids as well.
How many kids have you got?
Oh, loads. Loads. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got, well, R. Lee, R. John, Jennifer, Tony Marie, R. Kelsey. I've got grandkids as well. I might even be having a great grandkid soon. Sorry if I've thrown it, lad, had you? Well, you better take it out. Sorry about that, lad. Did your dad know?
You know, you said at the start, obviously, you wanted to make your mum proud. When we've talked about this stuff, and if she was looking at you now and the conversation that we're having,
yeah,
and with the experiences you've been through, do you think she'd be proud?
I know my mum was proud of me, but it must have hurt her, you know, like, here's her son who's gone on to saving the Royal Navy as a mine clearance diver, saving the Falklands, gone on to captain the British team in the Olympics, captain England, captain combined services, captain Royal Navy, ABA champion, doing well. And then all of a sudden, a grade four, and he's convicted of murdering a soulmate. You know, and broke her heart. Not only lost a soulmate and a firstborn, hasn't she? You know, because people like to exploit and use and whatever. Good luck to them.
That's a horrible position for you to be in.
It is all the time, you know, I just give myself, I'm just me, I just give myself, yeah, either like it, or chew me up and spit me out, and the majority of times you just get exploited, either by the establishment or by your criminal fraternity, everyone wants to be seen with Chewy, you know, or everyone has Chewy sound, you know, there's some genuine people, and there's some not so genuine who just have your eyes out or stab you in the back.
Do you think people know the real Brian Schumacher, or do you think your reputation precedes you?
I think those that know me, you know. Those that meet me always say, well, I didn't expect it to be like this, you know. It's
you take me by surprise, to be fair. After reading all that stuff, obviously, right, that I've repeated to you, yeah, and now you smile at me. I don't know if you're half thinking that you're going to wipe the floor with me in a minute or what.
No.
I've enjoyed it. It's been good.
And you haven't even had a cup of tea off me. That's the funny thing. I make a great cup of tea according to my bed. Well, my ex-bed.
Couldn't have been that good.
Yeah. I could go on about a few things, but, you know, it's a children's programme.
Well, I hope you continue to find some inner peace, because obviously you're stuck with what you've got, but obviously what you can do is create your new paths moving forwards. And I hope that you focus that and you can channel it.
I'd like to channel it. I'd like to go and speak to schools, and I'd like to go and speak to youngsters and that, and educate them about criminal being around negative people.
Making choices.
And making choices, yeah. And some of them choices are going to be difficult. I'm not trying to say I know everything, but if I can just trigger something in your mind to help you or support you or guide you, you know, great, isn't it? You know, and that's what I'd like to do. That's all I want to do. I've got long left on this earth. You all haven't, really. Not with this COVID, anyway. God bless them souls that I've lost. It's quite an intimidating and scary time, isn't it?
Yeah, particularly, obviously, when you're not used to being outside, full stop.
Well, you know, I can go and sit in a pub and abuse myself, which I have done in the past, since I got out. But I'm going to turn myself around now. It's been nice and a pleasure to, and I feel really honoured. I don't know how I've deserved to get interviewed and be on this stage, but, like, all these people got to understand. I did try on the internet thing. What's it called?
On the computer, Facebook, social media, thing. Social stuff.
Yeah, I was just overrun. And, you know, as soon as I put something on to say happy birthday or something to someone, I was just inundated with, turn it off. I don't know how to do it. I really don't know how to do it. But those of you that know me and know me, I just want to say hi, and I'm not dead yet, not long, but that thing on the computer or whatever it's called, internet, I'm not dead. All those that have helped in the past, I'll continue to support, and I just want to say a big shout out to Tony Bevel and Paul Kelly and all the guys to do with the ex Royal Navy and Royal Marines Boxing Association, who've been so supportive. And lads, all you Xboxers, you know, keep it on, keep it together, be the family. Be the family. That's what we are, a family. Yeah, I just want to say thanks to Davey Robb and J.O. and all the lads from the Devon Navy boxing team. I'd like to contact all the England team again. I'd like to contact all my friends again. But unfortunately, I'm just feeling sorry for myself at the moment, stuck in this hostel and struggling financially. So be lucky, be safe, and keep smiling.
Brian, thank you so much for your time, mate. I appreciate it.
Nice one. Thank you. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Premier Sports. Premier Sports will have live and exclusive coverage of Terence Crawford and Kell Brook in the welterweight world title showdown on Sunday morning, November the 15th. The Crawford-Brook telecast will also include the highly anticipated rematch between WBA super flyweight world champion Joshua Franco and former world champion Andrew Maloney. Premier Sports is available in HD via Sky, Virgin and online via the Premier Player available on app and desktop. Full coverage begins from 12:30 a.m. on Premier Sports 1 and new customers can sign up from just $9.99 per month via the website www.premiersports.com.
I'm nearly speechless having re-listened to that from Brian. I don't really know what to say. You know, we covered so much ground. It's one of the wildest rides I've been on, and I was just a passenger for 90 minutes. I can't imagine what Brian thinks and feels and, you know, wonders how his life's turned out and, you know, maybe the hopes and ambitions and the expectations he had, which seemed modest, really, in many ways at the start. But obviously to be a to serve in the Navy and be the captain of the British boxing teams, he talks there about Daley Thompson and Seb Coe and all the rest of it. It's absolutely crazy. It's an absolutely wild ride. A reminder before I move on that we do have a Boxing Life Stories page on Instagram, so check us out, Boxing Life Stories. I'm also on Patreon. It helps if you support the podcast. That would be enormously appreciated. You can find us at www.patreon.com/TrisDixon. And huge thanks to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing, who were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm in 2020 at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. And Delco Safety Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs. And you can find out more about them at delcosafety.co.uk. Huge thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. I think I'll still be catching my breath from the crazy Brian Schumacher. What a story.